Welcome to the Actionable Futurist podcast, a show all about the near-term future with practical and actionable advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and actionable futurist Andrew Grill.
Today's guest on the podcast is Sue Walter, who is the CEO of Maggie and Rose, London's first and best loved family members club. Sue's no stranger to members clubs, having been the CEO of the hospital club when we actually met. She has had a diverse and interesting career, having started in HR with Metropolitan Police before being the HR director at the Royal Opera House, worked for Universal Music, and joined the hospital club for the first time in 2002. She's also worked in the education sector and was group CEO of the Copper Club before joining Maggie and Rose at the end of 2019. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Andrew. It's lovely to see you.
Now, Sue, we are no strangers. Full disclosure, we've known each other for nearly 10 years. Do you remember the time we actually met at the hospital club?
I do, actually. I remember it very, very clearly. It was in my, I think it might have even been my first week at the hospital club. And I decided, I don't know if you remember, Andrew, but when I took over the hospital club, it was actually in a pretty bad way. It was, the club was failing. And I decided that the most important thing that I needed to do when I joined the club was to find out what was going wrong. And I felt that the best way to do that was to actually meet the members and see what they had to say. So I ran a series of discussion groups called Have Your Say. And I think you may have come to either the first or the second one, and that's how we met.
It really set the tone for not just our friendship, but the way I see your management style, which is fantastic. I was telling my walking buddy this morning that I was really excited about interviewing you, and you had a great management style. And importantly, it wasn't just a, okay, let's find out, I'm new to the CEO, let's find out what people do and don't like. It permeated through the whole time at the club. And I remember that because it was a members club and had multiple levels, more often than not, if I was at the club, I would see you walking around, you'd be talking to the staff, the members. And it was really, you had a very different approach. And it's something I've tried to do in my leadership style as well. But back to Maggie and Rose, for those not familiar, what's the concept behind Maggie and Rose?
So Maggie and Rose was founded back in 2006. It was founded by two young mothers who basically were frustrated with the lack of facilities available to families with young children. And sadly, my son was too old when it was launched, but I remember too well when my son was young. You know, the choices that I had were to either take my son with me to adult places where people would roll their eyes and tut if he threw a wobbly, which children often do, or I would have to go to ballparks with him, which were not really designed for me as an adult. And there was nothing really which was designed for both adults and young children. And Maggie Bolger, who was the original founder, her husband at the time was on the board of Soho House. So they came up with the idea of kind of a Soho House for families, which is the best way to describe Maggie and Rose. So it is very much an environment which caters both for children, but is still beautifully designed and, you know, well run, so that adults also feel that it's catering for them as well.
And I've actually been to your Kensington facility way back when my daughter was having birthday parties with her friends when she was in London. We actually had a birthday party there with one of her friends. So when you joined as CEO, I thought, oh, I've been to one of those. I know exactly what it's all about. And it's a great space. It really is.
And it was the first of its kind. And since then, obviously, there are a number of family members clubs which have launched. But at the time that it was launched, it was very much cutting edge. And I do remember at the time thinking, God, I wish that had been around when my son was younger. So yeah, there's definitely a need for it.
You joined Maggie and Rose at a really interesting time. You were doing rapid overseas expansion, then COVID closed everything down. How did you adapt back in March 2020?
It happened so fast. I don't know if you remember, Andrew, but the Prime Minister announced, I think, the lockdown on a Monday, and we were locked down by that Friday. And it was so fast. So we didn't really have time to think about it. We had to mobilize. We had to galvanize really quickly. If we're honest, although we knew about the pandemic and we heard about COVID, I think to some extent in the UK, we felt it would be similar to previous pandemics where they didn't quite touch the UK. So I think it came as a shock that actually it hit us, and it hit us as hard as it did. In terms of the business, we immediately went into action mode. So the immediate thing was, we knew we were going to have to close our clubs and our nurseries. We had like 3 or 4 days in which to get them closed down and to communicate with our members, to communicate with our staff, to figure out what we needed to do. And the immediate priority was to put those things in place. But once we started working on task, we then it was then my job to think beyond that. Once we've closed it down, we are a community. So what do you do with a community when there is no space for that community to be and to connect? And immediately my mind started to think about, well, we have to pivot. We have to create something online because we can't just simply shut down the clubs and then leave our community without any kind of support or contact for however long the lockdown was going to be. And at that time, we didn't know. We did know it would be at least 6 months. So at the same time that we were quickly locking down our business, we were trying to build a digital platform to migrate our community to. And the reason I'm smiling, Andrew, is we pretty much set up a digital platform in 4 days. And my original business plan when I took over Maggie and Rose, you know, I was going through the whole market testing, proof of concept, and I was thinking it would take 12 months to get it off the ground. We ended up, the reality is we ended up doing it in 4 days.
That's a really great story because I think most people had to basically pivot and go from working in an office to being online. And I was doing a webinar with a law firm the other day, and I was talking about the fact that, like you said, if you were doing this the old way, you would do pilots and tests and it would take months, if not years, because there are barriers in the way. The barriers were removed because the government said you have to do this. So moving forward, if you want to do something as dramatic as a new product or a service or an opening, how will you take the learnings of what you did in 4 days and accelerate things going forward? What have you learned and what can you take on from that?
That's a great question. I think for me, the key learning is that I've worked in so many different environments, and one of the things that I think we're all guilty of is perhaps overanalyzing and overthinking things. And I think, you know, whilst, you know, I'll put my hands up, we made a lot of mistakes because we set something up in 4 days and we were literally learning as we were going along. But having said that, we did set it up and we got it into the market and it was doing its job. And then we started shaping it in real time. So to me, there is a balance to be had between putting something out into the market without properly understanding your market and overanalyzing something to the extent where you become paralyzed by analysis and it takes you far too long to put something out. And by the time you put it out, it's too late already. So for me, it's the big benefit that we had when we launched in 4 days was that we did understand our market. We knew our community. We knew what they wanted. We knew what they needed. We knew that there was going to be all these parents at home with young children and they were going to be panicking. What are we going to do with our kids? How are we going to cope? How are we even going to have the communication with our child about what COVID is and why they have to be at home and why they can't be at school? So we knew our audience. So the question for us was really, okay, we just need to get something out there because we know who our audience is and we know that the product won't be perfect. And the key thing for us was that we just communicated with our members. We just said, look, we're getting this out because we know you need the connection, you need the support, but it's not perfect. And we want you to help us to shape it, to make sure it's meeting your needs. So the learning for me really is that actually, as long as you know your audience, as long as you know your market, sometimes it's okay just to jump into the deep end and swim and then figure it out once you're in. And would I do something in 12 months next time? Not necessarily. Maybe I could do it in 4 months or 6 months. So I think it definitely has shaved quite a lot off that process. But you do need to know your market. I think if we'd kind of jumped into the deep end without really knowing our audience, I just think it would have been a disaster from the beginning.
Now, I know you're surrounded by a great team at all of the clubs. How did the staff adapt to this rapid change?
It was interesting because we had two sets of teams, really. So we had the largest part of our team, nearly 80% of our team, went into furlough early on. And the you know, they had to adapt to a world with work to suddenly a world with no work. And then I had a very, very small team who stayed behind with me and helped us really pivot and build the digital piece. The team that stayed working with me adapted really well. That we suddenly went into task mode. There were a lot of things that needed to be done in a very short period of time. And then even when we launched the platform, we were constantly thinking, how can we make it better? How can we improve it? So we were backed up. We were busy. And I think that helped. I think it was actually harder for the people who were at home to adapt, in all honesty, because suddenly, you know, they went from having a world which was full of work to a world where, to begin with, it was fun and they could go for walks and they could make soda bread and they can connect with family. But as the months wore on, their sense of connection and their sense of purpose started to erode. And I think that's been the hardest thing for us, actually.
Now, I read on the website that the membership's actually held in the name of the child and they get to decide who comes and joins them at the club. So what was the response to this online platform from your junior members?
That was one of the things that we really had to evolve, because to begin with, we just thought, let's take the classes that we do in our clubs and let's digitize them and start doing classes for our online platform. And it was well received by our junior members, particularly because they were seeing teachers that they recognized from the club and so there was some familiarity there. But I think as time wore on, it became a concern to us and to parents that it was passive and it was just passive screen time. The kids were just looking at the screen. And here's the rub for us at Maggie and Rose, because we encourage togetherness, we discourage too much screen time, but suddenly our only medium of communication was screen time. So what the digital team started working on was really, how can we make this more interactive? How can we make it less passive? So towards the end of the last summer, my team came up with a fantastic idea, which was really where the kids get to create their own stories online. They get to contribute to the content. They get to say what happens next. They get to actually email in ideas of things that they want to see covered. So they became a participant in the content creation rather than just a passive observer of it, I suppose.
Which in a way, the whole product has refined itself from instant market feedback.
That's exactly it. And I think it never sat right with me from the beginning, the fact that we were doing something which was very passive for children, because it really goes against the whole ethos of Maggie and Rose. So from the beginning, it didn't sit well, but it was kind of needs must. But then, as you say, it evolved as a result of market feedback. And as we were able to really build up our junior followers online, we were then able to properly engage with them. And it was great. I mean, if you go onto the digital platform now, there are children's voices that, you know, they're telling stories, they're getting involved in the content creation. And we want to do a lot more child user-generated content or user-driven content by children.
So it leads me to a follow-on question. Will you keep the digital offering post-COVID, and does it give you flexibility in your offerings?
Absolutely. I mean, long before COVID, I'd always felt that we needed a digital platform because, the clubs and mortar model is slow and it's capital intensive in terms of opening up clubhouses. And there are communities all over the world where you have young parents who need support, who want to connect with other parents. So from the beginning, it was always my vision that one day we would have an e-membership for cities which don't have clubhouses and don't have access to Maggie and Rose resources. So that is still very much where I would like to take the digital product, is one day I would like to be able to perhaps put an extra layer on that and turn that into an e-membership that we can actually launch in new territories. So that's where I see it going. But I would still like to keep the basic level digital community, which we've created, as accessible to all parents. And then I'd like to then build an e-membership on top of that.
The theme of International Women's Day this year was Choose to Challenge. What did you choose to challenge and why?
We all have our own personal challenges that we deal with. So I thought a lot about my personal challenges, but then I thought, actually, no, that's not quite in keeping with International Women's Day theme this year, which is about extrinsic things that are going on. So for me, what I thought about is I was bullied at school when I was young. I was bullied for years. And back then, I didn't feel that I had a voice to challenge bullies. So it just went unchallenged for years. And in my adult life, I think, as I developed a voice where I didn't have a voice, I've always chosen to challenge bullies, because I think I know from personal experience just how hard it is to challenge that sort of behavior when you don't feel that you either have the voice or the authority to do that. And I think ultimately it's just not okay to build yourself up by diminishing other people. And that's really what bullies do. And I think constructive challenge is always good. When I think of challenge, I don't think of, you know, shouting at people and pointing at them in a boardroom or something. I think this is about really seeking to understand before being understood. And I think as I've gotten older, I've learned that it's not enough just to challenge the behavior. I think you have to better understand the root cause. Why do people behave the way that they do? I think that most bullies don't like themselves. I know that sounds like a very broad statement, but I think they don't like themselves. I don't think they necessarily like their behavior. I think that they too are hurting, and they're taking out that hurt on other people. So I think we have to learn to understand the cause of behavior and deal with that in order to break that cycle. So for me, it's really about better understanding why people do what they do and then working towards breaking that cycle. And for me, that's how I choose to challenge.
I was bullied at school as well. And at the time I thought, why am I being bullied? And as I've gone through life, I've always looked back at the, and I went to an all-boys school, just to see, maybe even through LinkedIn, what did they make of themselves? Did they overcome that behavior? And I think if I ever met them again at a school reunion, and I think we did actually 10 years in and had a very different discussion because they'd grown up and matured. But what a waste to go through the early formative years just not liking yourself or not liking people. It's such a waste.
I couldn't agree more. Did you find it quite cathartic when you met them at the reunion?
Yeah, because they actually had a whole different view of me. By then I'd become successful and they knew that. I need to respect you now because you're an equal, whereas before they saw themselves as better than me, which is kind of crazy.
Exactly, and that's what I mean. It's about diminishing others in order to make yourself feel good about yourself. And that doesn't come from a good place. That comes from a dark place. And I think, you know, when you are the victim of bad behavior, sometimes I think we have, as human beings, we have the tendency to make it about us, but actually it's not about us. It's about that person and how they feel about themselves.
What roles have mentors played in your career to date? And can you name some really great people that have mentored you?
Mentors have meant so much to me in my life. I mean, it's been completely life-changing for me. When I was growing up, my parents were working all the time. So I didn't really have adult influence around me in that respect. And when I looked out, you know, into the world, I didn't see women who looked like me doing things. Most of the women from my background, from my community, were getting married, having children, and that was all that was expected of them. So for me, having mentors has meant, you know, it's almost like somebody looking at you and seeing a different part of you that you don't see yourself. And I think and I missed having that kind of reflection in my early life. So I think my first mentor, I was fortunate enough actually to have a mentor in my first ever job in the civil service. And she was my line manager at the time. And when I left university, I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I just kind of wandered into the civil service, and it was always supposed to be a stopgap. But my line manager saw in me qualities which I didn't even see myself. And she felt that I was really good with people. I was really good with influencing. I was good at getting the best out of people. So she encouraged me to go back to university and get a HR qualification. And she was the one that encouraged me to go into HR when I had no direction whatsoever. And it was under her guidance that I moved into that. And I ended up, the first part of my career, you know, I ended up becoming very successful in HR. I rose to HR director and worked in some amazing organizations. But that can all be traced back to her and her encouragement. And then later on in my career, after having built a successful career in HR, another line manager was also a mentor. This time it was a man, and he pushed me into operational management. Again, he saw something in me, Andrew, which I didn't see in myself. He felt that I wasn't just working in HR. He felt that I was actively impacting on business strategy and helping our business leaders to perform better, to enhance the performance of their business units. And he basically pushed me out of HR and practically frog marched me into my first MD role. And I remember being terrified at the time, but he was so forceful and he had so much belief in me that I just didn't want to let him down. And he definitely impacted me. So those two pivots were both as a result of mentors. And then I think the biggest mentor and the person whose voice I still hear in my head is Paul Allen, who I met when I was at the hospital club. Most people will know him as co-founder of Microsoft. The code that he created for Microsoft has changed the world forever. In addition to Microsoft, he was also one of the world's great thinkers. And I loved our talks because we would sit and talk for hours and he would always encourage me to think outside the box. His favorite questions were, so what and what if? And he inspired and challenged me and still does. You know, today I can still hear his voice in my head asking what if. And he always, you know, that's, we all need people in our lives who see things in us that we don't see in ourselves, but also who propel us to think bigger and stretch out our arms further and go faster than we thought we could. Because, you know, we are our own worst enemies in terms of self-limiting beliefs. We will always hold ourselves back and tell ourselves all the reasons why we can't do something. And I think having that voice outside of yourself, which says, yes, you can do it, and here's why you can do it. And that's why I think mentors are important.
Sadly, Paul passed away a few years ago, but I know that he would have been saying, of course you need to go and be CEO of Maggie and Rose. This is perfect for you, Sue.
He didn't place any limitations on himself. You know, when he died, he was writing a book, and it was, sadly, he never got to finish the book, but it was an incredibly ambitious book. In this book, he broke down what he saw as four or five of the world's greatest problems that we were facing, and this book was all about his ideas for solutions to those problems, whether it was climate change or whether it was global poverty or pandemics, and it's an incredibly ambitious book for someone to write, but that's how he thought. He always thought big, and he always thought beyond the limitations, and he certainly never placed those limitations on himself, and I think that inspired people around him to do the same.
A controversial question for you. Do you think women make better leaders and make better boardroom decisions?
I'm going to say no to that because I'll tell you why. I don't think they make worse leaders or better leaders. The way I think about it is I don't tend to think about good leadership or leadership capability as being driven by gender. I think in my career, when I spoke about my mentors earlier, I had a female mentor and a male mentor. And in my career, I've worked with great and terrible leaders. And I've learned a lot from both of them. And they were men and women on both sides of that spectrum. So to me, a great leader, a good leader, is defined by their personal attributes rather than their gender. So I don't think it's as linear as that.
I like to think of diversity in terms of diversity of thought, and that can come from creed, religion, gender. And I know myself, when I was on the Rotary Club of Sydney board, I always loved the diversity of thought from my female co-board people, because you think differently, because the species are different. And so just as I talk about a thing with the two tribes in every organization, there are the born leaders, there are the going digital and there are the born digital, and they think differently. And I think it challenges you. So again, I don't really see gender either, but my goodness, my female friends just have a different view from things I have, and they challenge me, and it's fantastic. So they just bring that diversity of thought you get from every type of diversity, I think, is what makes the world go round.
100%. One of the attributes that makes a great leader is the ability to surround yourself with great people. And I think, to me, a great team is a diverse team. If it's not diverse, it's not a great team. And that's diversity in sex, in ethnicity, in background, even in if you surrounded yourself with Oxbridge graduates, you're going to get one train of thought. And if, so for me, it's why wouldn't I, because this is my advisory team, why would I not surround myself by the people who are going to give me the best and most diverse advice, and who are going to say no to me and who are going to challenge me, because those things push me to be a better person and a better leader. So to me, you're absolutely right, Andrew. I think, having diversity of thought around the board table 100% is important, not just male, female, it's the complete gambit of mix. However, to be a great leader, I don't think it matters whether you're male or female.
I listened to a recent podcast where you said that to solve gender equality, you need men at the table. Why do you think that's important?
Most societies in the world, if not all of them, started out as being a patriarchy. So the roots of the patriarchy, the legacy, are so deep rooted. And I think in order to unpick that legacy and really build lasting change, this is not about temporary change. This is about lasting change. And you and I both know, Andrew, because we've both worked in large and small organizations, that in order to get lasting change, all stakeholders have to be signed up to that change. Yeah. So to me, the gender equality argument is no different than any other major change that one is trying to implement. So you have to have all the stakeholders at the table. And I think absolutely men have to be a part of that discussion, not least because of historical issues. Not men are bad, women are good. Just because of historical issues, men have always been in that more senior, more supreme position. And I think, therefore, they have a role to play, both in terms of educating themselves about the issues, but the role that they can play in terms of influencing change. And then I think, more and more, I talk a lot to my male friends who are all in different parts of industry. And more, they're becoming stakeholders as fathers of young daughters, and as sons, and as brothers and husbands. And all my male friends who have daughters, they don't want their daughters to be held back. They want amazing things for their daughters. They want their daughters to achieve and be everything that they want to be. And I think as men are starting to embrace their roles in women's lives, whether it's as partners or brothers or fathers, they are wanting that equality for the people that they love in their lives, every bit as women want it. And I think, that men have a stake as much as women do. And I think from a woman's point of view, it shouldn't be a competition. It shouldn't be us against you. It should really be that, you know, you're our colleagues, you're our allies, you're our partners, and we need you at the table to help us find solutions, but also to help us challenge this behavior in the boardroom. Going back to what we were talking about bullies at the beginning, sometimes women, particularly in more junior management positions, do not feel empowered and do not feel that they have a voice. If there is a more senior man in the room and there is inappropriate behavior, then I think men have a role to play in challenging that behavior and making it okay to challenge that behavior.
We're both Gen X. I won't give away our ages, but we're similar in age, which means the people that follow us may not have these issues because they may say, well, of course there's gender equality. Why are we even discussing it? So do you have some advice for Gen Y, Gen Z, and the new one, Gen Alpha?
With my son, what's interesting is I've never really had to sit him down and say, you have to respect women, you have to do this, you have to do that. He just naturally, I mean, in his mind, there are no limits to what women can achieve. He's never thought about it in those terms, and he's 19. And I honestly believe that my generation in particular, you know, I can remember early on, I started working in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and I can tell you stories that would make your hair curl about, you know, men and women and how they worked in the workplace. But I actually think there is a whole generation which is coming up now, which is not going to experience that. For them, it's going to be normal as digitization of the workplace. I think it will just be. However, there is still, as you said, Gen Y, without disclosing our age, is I think Gen Y has a lot of work still to do because we have that legacy. I can still remember a workplace when I was excluded because I was a woman. But my son's generation will not remember that because that will not be a factor of their workplace.
Back to the hospital club, because it was a big part of your life. Do you have a favourite memory of your time at the club?
On a personal level, we all have the great love of our lives that we will always remember. And in work terms, you know, without diminishing anything from my other work environments, the hospital club, I guess, is the great love of my life in terms of my work environment. And the reason for that is there are just so many memories, so many happy memories. And I'm not making this up. I used to leap out of bed every morning and I couldn't wait to get into work. And how many people can say that about their job? But if you force me to come up with one memory, so the 10-year anniversary, the hospital club had been around for 10 years. And I don't know how many people know this, but the building of the hospital club was very significant in the Second World War and in the First World War. And we decided to mark its 10-year anniversary to do a nod to the Second World War. And we brought in a swing band and people dressed up in as Wrens and as RAF pilots. And we basically recreated a Second World War base. I remember just walking around this building and we were like transported back to the late 1930s, early 1940s. And everyone was happy, everyone was smiling, and every single part of the building was humming and buzzing, and people felt a real sense of ownership and pride over this organization that had lasted for 10 years. And it was just, you know, I mean, I wish I could just, sometimes you wish you can just freeze time, and that was one of the moments I wished I could freeze time, because it was just a moment of just pure pride and happiness. And I always look at that and think, yeah, that was an amazing night.
I'm so glad you mentioned that you really like going to work, because it showed on your face. Every time I'd see you there, you were always happy. It was such a place because for a number of reasons. I mean, I remember brushes with fame in the lift. I mean, I rode the lift with Annie Lennox from Rhythmics, and Dave Stewart, who was one of the co-founders, he was there a lot. I got to tell you a couple of my favorite memories. Dave did a couple of nights for members. The first night, he actually had his daughter there, and he stripped back Sweet Dreams to just one or two tracks, and that was just amazing. And the second time he performed, he basically made up a vodka commercial on the spot with ideas from the crowd. And it's like, where are you going to have Dave Stewart write an ad for you to a room of 100 people over an evening? It's things like that that I'll never forget. It was really a magical place.
As a co-founder, Dave, as you know, was so engaged in the space. And, you know, some of my favorite memories of Dave was, you know, when we introduced bedrooms into the hospital club, I don't know, I'm sure you probably saw this, but, you know, he would stay over in the bedrooms and then he would treat the club as if it was his living room. And he would come down in his dressing gown and his hat straight from his bedroom, and he would go to the bar and he would order a martini in the evening in his dressing gown. And it was just this kind of quirkiness, and there was always something going on in the club, and that was the really wonderful, exciting thing. It didn't matter whether you came in the morning or the afternoon or the evening, there was always something, and you know, people were always telling stories. Oh, did you see this happened at the club, or that I met this person, or I saw this thing, and you know, it's lovely to hear your stories about it as well.
When I was at IBM, I would actually have a lot of my meetings there because it was far more interesting than our building in South Bank. And it became an event. So people who hadn't ever been to the Hospital Club, I mean, there are lots of clubs in London, as many people know. There's Soho House and Shoreditch and everything else. But there was something about going, meet me in the Hospital Club. And it was, well, I haven't been there. And I've had my daughter's birthday parties there. I would host friends for movie nights. And I had my birthday there a couple of years ago. And it was really like, oh, this is a cool place, Andrew. And they thought more of me. They thought I was even cooler because I was a member of this cool club. The Hospital Club made me cool.
Well, you are cool, Andrew. But I think that's a lovely thing that you mentioned about the club. And that's to me is the secret of a really great members club, is the fact that people connect and they meet each other. And you know, you and I met, and we're still friends today 10 years later, and you know, there are so many people in my life today who I met because of the Hospital Club and are still in my life, and I think that to me is the secret of a great members club. I think where you can go in, not know anybody, and 2 hours later you've left and you've met and you know someone.
I'm not sure a product extension of having martinis at Maggie and Rose is probably going to cut it just yet.
Not quite, no. But we do serve drinks for parents, because obviously parents do, as you and I know, sometimes need a drink.
I'm sure you've been given a lot of advice from a lot of your mentors, but what's the best piece of advice you've been given, and who gave it to you?
I've always been really, really hard on myself. I'm a perfectionist like most people in my role, and nothing I've done in my life has ever been good enough. It could have always been better. And my first line manager, the woman who encouraged me, Maureen, who encouraged me to get into HR, she saw that, you know, she could see that I was always frustrated with myself and never quite being good enough. And she picked up, she was a wise woman, and she picked up that the reason I was frustrated with myself is I was always comparing myself against other people who I thought had done better. They'd got better degrees, or they had lived in a better place, or they've achieved more of their lives and they had more direction, because I never had direction. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I always found myself, I always found myself coming short when I compared myself with others. And Maureen said to me, Sue, don't ever compare yourself with other people, because everyone's journey is unique to them. And actually, you should only ever compare yourself by how far you've come on your own journey relative to where you began, because where I started and where you started is completely different places. And I may have come a hell of a lot longer than you have, but to the outside world, it might look like you're more successful than me, but actually I've come a longer way on my journey. And I think that was really important to me, because at that point I stopped looking externally and started thinking about myself and my own journey and how far I had come on my own journey. And I think we can only ever measure success. Success should never be measured by the extrinsic. We can only measure success by our own personal journey. And it's not always obvious to the outside world. It's not always milestones that are clearly marked. Sometimes it's overcoming our own personal demons.
You mentioned you're the mum of a teenager, and I was actually fortunate the other week to appear on his radio show. He asked me a lot of really probing questions, and it was funny to listen to it back. What's the best piece of advice you've given him to date, and has he taken it on board?
I grew up in a very strict Muslim household where everything was defined for us. Thinking for yourself was never encouraged. So I think I've tried to raise my son in a way where he can think for himself, he can figure things out, make his own mistakes. And I've tried to give him values and boundaries within which to operate, because ultimately as parents, we just want our children to be good people. And I think that has to be probably the advice that I've given him. The rest of it he's figured out himself. But I've tried to encourage him to always be kind and to pay it forward and to treat people with respect. Apart from anything else in life, you just never know when things will come around again. But I do believe that if you can, as a mantra in life, if you can treat people with respect, if you can treat people well, I don't think you will ever regret that. And I've known a lot of people who perhaps have not treated people well, and they find it hard. You know, they've never really found peace within themselves. And I'm very proud of the fact that whatever I've done, even if I've had to do really difficult things in my life, like make people redundant, for example, I've always tried to be humane and kind and considerate to people. And I hope that my son will be the same.
You're certainly someone that inspires me because I love your management style, the way you dealt with staff at the club and just the way you approach being a manager and a leader. But who inspires you and why?
More by accident than by design, but I've had an amazing, incredible career and I've met so many amazing people. And, you know, I have lots of little bits that I've gathered from all the people I've met, including you, Andrew, without wishing to make you blush. And I told you, you know, I learned something from listening to your podcast the other day and I made a change within my life as a result of that. But I think by far the person who has influenced me the most in terms of driving my career and my life is my mother. Those of you perhaps who've heard me being interviewed before will know that my mother never went to school. She grew up in a country at a time when girls didn't go to school. And there's a great story, which I've never shared with anyone else, actually, but I'm sharing with you, Andrew, where when my mother was about 10 years old, she was the only girl with five brothers. And when she was 10 years old, she cut off all her hair and put on her brother's clothes and snuck into the local school because she was so desperate to go to school. And she pretended to be a boy. And she managed to get away with it for about 3 months where she was going to school. And they just thought she was a boy until one of her brothers found out. And then she was basically pulled out of school. But that's how important education was to her. She was so desperate. And she still says the 3 months that she spent at school were the happiest of her time. And the reason why my mother inspires me is not because of what she's achieved in her life, but what she hasn't achieved. Because I often wonder if my mother had been given the opportunities I've been given, if she went to school, for example, what could she have done with her life? Who could she have been today? And it's quite possible I wouldn't even be here if my mother had gone to school, because maybe she just would have had a completely different life. But I've watched her throughout her life become smaller and smaller as a person because she never got to be the things that she wanted to be. And I think she inspires me to really appreciate and take advantage of all the opportunities that I've been given in life, because she never had those. And I think, you know, I feel like the greatest accolade I can give her is to make something of myself and to actually embrace the opportunities in my life that have come to me. And to me, she's just a constant reminder of the many women around the world, not just her, who have never had the opportunities we've had. So I think the fact that she never got to live the life that she wanted has driven me to just embrace every opportunity and to try and live my fullest life, I think.
We're now recording this in the end of March 2021. So a lot of people have had the vaccine, including myself. We've now got some level of freedom because we can meet in groups of six. What challenges do you foresee as we navigate our way out of lockdown for the company, for yourself and for your team?
I think the biggest challenge certainly from my personal experience with Maggie and Rose is for us to learn to reconnect on a human level, actually, because we've spent the last year living in a virtual world, and there are some members of my team which I haven't actually seen physically in 12 months. And, you know, whilst working in a digital space has definitely created efficiencies and it's definitely helped people have a better balance, particularly family, you know, members of my team with young families, I think it's definitely helped them. The downside of it has been perhaps that it's perpetuated a little bit more silo working. And I feel like we haven't innovated as much as we could have done when we're all in the same space and there's ideas bouncing off each other. And it's almost like we've forgotten how to relate to each other. And I remember I was reading something, about 6 or 7 months ago about war veterans coming back from the war and having to learn how to relate to their families again, because, you know, for a long time they just connected by, you know, they would write letters or send emails, and they had to learn how to relate to people face to face. And personally, I believe that's going to be the biggest challenge for us, at least for the next 6 months, is learning how to be a team together again in a physical sense.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm seeing a lot of that. And there have been a lot of mental health issues along the way. And now you're throwing people back in the same space again. I've got friends of mine who clearly that they don't want to go back to the office because they like being out of that environment. And you mentioned bullies. And I think that's part of it, that some of the environments that they work in, and some of my friends work in pretty high-pressure finance roles, there's inherent bullying that goes on. And maybe they're not calling it bullying, but the reason they like being at home is they don't have to surround themselves. So that, I think, will be really, really challenging. But we kind of alluded to technology and digital platforms. What's the best use of tech that you've seen in the last 12 months?
I caveat this with saying I'm not an expert in the tech space. I'm definitely that, you know, Gen Y where I'm learning about it rather than, you know, it's integrated and it's in my blood. But I think obviously, you know, there's the obvious stuff in the workplace, but the stuff in the workplace that we're seeing is possible because of a technology development called 5G, as you know, and that's enabled us to work faster, to be more proactive. It's enabled better connectivity. It's enabled better use of data. But to me, outside of the workplace, I feel like 5G technology is just got so much more mileage in it in terms of the things that we can do with it. And particularly going back to some of the things that we talked about, some of the bigger global issues, for example, one of the things I was reading in The New Scientist is that 5G is now playing a really instrumental part in helping to combat climate change, for example. So, for example, as a result of improved computer processing power, which has been brought about by the 5G technology, scientists are now able to attribute the role of climate change to severe weather events. And this knowledge is really important because not only does it help us to figure out how to predict and plan for severe weather events, but it also, more importantly, provides us with the evidence that holds organizations and countries to account for their contribution to climate change. And this is really, to me, this is game changing, because I think climate change has been going on for so long and there's so much finger pointing, but lack of accountability. And even when you're trying to hold people to account, I think there's a lack of data to be able to back that up. And I think as a result of this, being able to actually link severe weather events with actual contributing factors, I think will enable us, number one, to be able to deal with those contributing factors, but secondly, to properly hold organizations and countries to account. So I do feel that 5G, and you know far more about this than I do, Andrew, but it feels to me like we haven't barely hit the tip of the iceberg on this one in terms of its reach.
I had the chief technology officer from Huawei on in the last series, and he talked about 5G beyond. I mean, people just think it's a speed improvement, that 5G is faster than 4G, but you're very right. It enables processing power at the edge. It also allows connectivity. We'll hear a lot about the Internet of Things, and networks at the moment have a capacity constraint, whereas 5G is almost unlimited. So I think we haven't heard the last of that technology, but it just gets faster and faster. So you know, I have a 5G MiFi. I mean, being a futurist, I play with all this stuff and I want to be at the cutting edge to see what I can do with it, and it'll only going to get better. Final question before we go into a quick fire round. How are you managing a good work-life balance in 2021?
Before the pandemic, I've never, ever worked from home. So the last year has been an education for me. And to begin with, I was thinking, this is great because I'll actually be able to have a better work-life balance. I think the reality has been the opposite in that the blurring of the lines between my work and my life has actually become even more so. And, you know, I do find I'm working earlier in the day. I'm working later in the day. I'm certainly working at weekends. Having said that, I can turn off the technology and put on my running shoes and go for a run. And that's not something I could have done when I was in the office. So there are, I am able to carve out moments for myself where I can just stop and go and clear my head. But the short answer is I'm not there yet with the balance. I think technology, if anything, has made that balance more difficult.
I've not met a single person that claims, yeah, we've mastered work-life balance, because it's an oxymoron. If you're working, then you don't have a balance.
The reality is both those things are important to me. You know, my work is important to me, but my life is also important. Unfortunately, for most people, work is monopolistic in the sense that it takes up far more of your personal life, perhaps, than is ideal. And that's going to be the lifelong struggle, really.
So let's go into a quick fire round. Quick answers are good answers. iPhone or Android?
iPhone.
PC or Mac?
Mac.
Biggest hope for 2021?
Biggest hope for 2021 is that we emerge from this pandemic, and as we do, that we do not lose sight of the lessons that we've learned over the last 12 months, because I think there has been some really great lessons. And I think as we get back to whatever normal looks like, I think it's very easy to perhaps lose sight of those lessons.
What are you reading at the moment?
At the moment, I am reading an Isaac Asimov book called The Naked Sun, which is really interesting, actually, because it was published in 1957, I believe. And in this book, he describes a world where people communicate completely by By technology. They don't, they're never in the same room. They basically contact each other. They communicate with each other in a screen or via an avatar. And it just felt very prophetic when I was reading it in the middle of a pandemic when I'm only communicating with people on the screen. But it's, you know, Asimov, as we know, was always writing about futuristic worlds, but this is a very opportune, and I didn't realize when I started reading the book, but this world where people, and actually what's interesting as well is people don't mix with each other physically because of fear of germs, of actually catching something, which is interesting. So the fear of catching something, the fear of germs, has driven society into a place where all communication is virtual.
Sounds like a book I should be reading. I'll put the link in the show notes. Final quickfire round question. How do you want to be remembered?
I think as someone who always left things better than the way she found them. I really believe whether you're a person or a corporation, I think in whatever small way that you can, you should always aspire to make things better. So yeah, that's how I'd like to be remembered.
I always ask my guests to provide some practical and pragmatic advice to our listeners. What three pieces of advice would you like to leave with us today?
I think in a world where people have two personas, their virtual persona and their own personal kind of private persona, I think it's really important to be authentic, because, you know, we're hearing so much fake this, fake that. And I think authenticity always cuts through. And I think don't play a role. It's not sustainable, because you can never be your best self if you're just trying to be an imitation of something. I think take the time, invest the time to figure out who you are, to figure out the things that are important to you, and then spend your life getting to know and like that person. One of my favorite quotes is Judy Garland. She said, be yourself, everyone else is taken. I think my second piece of advice is, it's okay not to have a plan or a roadmap for your life. I never had one. I genuinely didn't know what I wanted to do. And actually, the interesting thing, it's a bit like going exploring without a map, because you sometimes surprise yourself with where you end up and you find places that you never realized. And the lack of a map for me has led me to some amazing experiences. I've met some incredible people because I didn't have an end goal and I was open. I was just open to whatever came along. And, you know, without being open to the opportunities, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you, Andrew. So I think being open and not kind of being restricted in your view of yourself. And last bit of advice would be, don't be afraid of failure. I held myself back up so many times in my life because I was afraid of failure. And it took me a long time to discover that failure needn't be the end of something. And I've learned so much more from my failures than I have from my successes. So in my experience, failure is often the beginning of something, not the end.
Three good points. Going back to point number two, which I would classify as serendipity, I've lived my life through serendipity. I wouldn't be here talking to you had I not taken chances and let serendipity take its hold. So thank you for that. How can people find out more about you and your work?
You can find me on LinkedIn. I'm always happy to connect with people. I'm also on Instagram under SueWalter13. And Maggie and Rose, please do look us up at maggieandrose.com. Our digital platform is Maggie and Rose Life. And we are also on Instagram, Facebook and LinkedIn.
Sue, thank you so much. It's always so lovely to speak with you. You've given all of us some amazing nuggets of wisdom and inspiration today. And I thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew.
Thank you for listening to the Actionable Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at actionablefuturist.com. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops delivered in person or virtually at actionablefuturist.com. Until next time, this has been the Actionable Futurist Podcast.